You're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno. This is Crack O' Dawn. I'm Barb, and here's George Lewis.
Hi, Barb.
Hey, George.
Am I on? Is this on?
You're on.
All right, I'm on. Great.
You're always on. So, should we just play something without further ado?
And oh, then, thanks on your headphones. Wow.
Okay. Yeah, headphones. Get official here.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do it. So what are you telling me? You know, just emailed him today.
Yeah, yeah.
As a matter of fact. That's Richard Teitelbaum on synthesizer, right?
Yeah.
I was just telling him all the flowers in the garden, actually. And he said, sounds colorful.
Sounds like it.
So this is a duet, like just...
Well, it's kind of the blues. It's kind of a quartet. Piece is called Blues, actually. It's Douglas Ewart playing the solo bass clarinet. Then Anthony Davis is kind of playing piano, and I think I'm doing something.
I'm sure you're always doing something.
I think I play in a couple seconds. There it is. Okay, it's a little early. I knew it was coming, you know. Piece is 17 years old. I should know it by now.
The piece is 17 years old?
Yeah, this was recorded like 78 or something. Yeah. I think this is the last record I was allowed to make for a while.
Why is that?
Well, I kind of got cut off for a moment there. I couldn't make any more records for a while. And then I got another one around about 93 that I was allowed to make another one.
You're kidding, of course.
Yeah,
you made 80 records. When did you make them all?
Well, the rest of them got made with other people's, on other people's music, playing the trombone. But in terms of organizing compositions or whatever, this was it for a while. This is the swan song.
Do you know why?
Well, I don't know, man. You know, these things happen, I guess, you know. I mean, a lot of people don't get on at all, so if I got on for a little while, that wasn't too bad, was it? I mean, it wasn't one of those Hollywood stories, right? It's just, you know, where if a guy disappears, you know, he was on drugs
for
20 years.
He was blacklisted in the 50s, you know.
You know,
McCarthy hearing.
We could play this. I have a CD about blacklisting. Actually, Buddy Collette talks on his oral history CD about blacklisting. It's kind of hip.
Blacks.
So now we're about to have the Anthony Davis solo. I'm sorry for all you purists. I shouldn't be talking around music, but, you know, you get familiar with it. You can do it. The blues solo, and the rest of us are playing just roots. And we kind of have this score that looks like old Morton Feldman that we're using in the background. But, you know, we do it our way. So in other words, it's you know, it looks like Morton Feldman, but we don't want it to sound like Morton Feldman. Not that interested in that.
You don't seem to have to worry about that.
Well, no, you use the procedure, but you get your own thing out of it. You know, you don't want to be, you know, I mean, we don't want to be accused of whatever it is, appropriation.
Is that it?
No. This is the improvisation now. We just played all the Morton Feldman stuff.
I was thinking that's really long, short 17 minutes.
Well, maybe it could be 15 minutes.
Is this your solo?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think it is.
George Lewis solo coming up.
That's what it sounds like. This is back to the Morton Feldman stuff.
Oh, I see now why you call it more like sparse.
Well, it's just these sort of boxes. You've seen those old cases from like the 50s. You had this little box, and it was a high. If it was the box was up high, you played a high note. If the box was down low, you played a low note. And that's what it looks like, except that we play the blues on it.
Cool.
Yeah, that's okay. It's just a way of abstracting the blues, as Muhal used to say.
I did tell him that, Richard, that you were on the show tonight, but I didn't realize that we'd be hearing... Well, we'd be hearing him playing, too. Well, and I said, when are you coming out? You know, with the little stars on either end.
Oh, yeah.
And he keeps pitifully saying they don't ask him. But
last time he was asked,
he didn't come. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Well, that wasn't his fault. He
sure
had the phone
was.
In. No, it wasn't. Because
no,
he
I'm
had the
kidding.
Phone in his part. He phoned in his part, and it was interesting because... You're playing on the computer. I mean, I don't have to listen to this. I know what I sound like. But we can talk about that later.
Okay.
Not bad. Richard solo comes up next. What is the end of this piece?
Oh. Ah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it ends like a kind of bedtime story or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We gotta wake up. Wake up. Wake up. No, that's really beautiful. So it's 14 years ago?
God, what is it? You're 78, 88? I guess that's a long time, yeah. Maybe more, 17. 17 minutes, one for every year. Since we had to hear this one last. Oh, it still works, I think.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Still play this piece. It seems to have an upper limit. You can play it with four people, but two of them have to be keyboard players. That seems to be how it works. After that, you can have other people. And they have to know at least a little bit about the blues in order to play it. They don't have to know a lot about the blues, but they have to know something.
So that was Richard Teitelbaum on synthesizer, Anthony Davis piano, George Lewis.
And Douglas Ewart.
Trombone and Doug Ewart on clarinet?
Bass clarinet, yeah.
Bass clarinet,
yeah.
Neat.
Yeah.
So I'm so happy you're here.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
Twice in 1 month. This is amazing. Sarah Cahill got to be on the morning concert, and I'm on the late night
the
concert.
Late night concert. So didn't you do something at SynMat tonight?
Yeah,
how'd
on
go?
Art Street. Luke Houtkamp, I played with him, and Luke has these pieces for computer and disc clavier, you know, the Yamaha player piano. And he had this piece, I was playing in his piece. It's kind of odd because what we do is we kind of trade. Normally when you do these kind of computer pieces, and we could play one to give you an example of what we did, you play with your own computer and you kind of know how it works because it's kind of this constructed personality that you set up. But then when you play with somebody else's computer, it's like playing with a whole different scene. You have to. It's like a blind date in a certain way. You have to sort of get to know this person, and then you sort of, like, at first it's, like, really weird, and then you figure out, well, certain things check out, like, you know, they don't slurp their food or whatever they do, they have table manners, you know, or whatever it is they're doing, you know, or they're not scratching in weird places. And so at that point, you know, you can sort of say, well, okay, now I can play some music with this thing, and so Luke's second piece sounded a bit like, it was kind of one finger Nancarrow. It was very interesting. It kept playing these kind of odd Nancarrow-like melodies, which maybe that seems kind of funny. I mean, because Nancarrow, maybe that's just what it made me think of because of the player-piano connection, you know.
So did you to get into it? I mean, did it just start working for you?
Oh, yeah, it was great. Oh, no, finally, right. You get into it because I mean, he's been doing it for a while, and you sort of see, a lot of people feel like, well, this is a way of interacting with, you know, your own personality, or somehow you're constructing this thing that's kind of an alternative for you, and that's not really how it works. I mean, the things you make, they don't really have to sound like you, or they don't have to behave like you. It's more like that there's a personality there than that the personality is somehow imitative of the person that made the thing. It's just that it's a personality that you have to deal with in interactive computer music, and it's there, and it's separate from you, and you kind of have to accept what it does, and, you know, and sometimes it's brilliant, and sometimes it completely misses the point, and well, so do you sometimes, and that's cool. You know, it ends up being cool. But, you know, I mean, we could play an example of it, actually. But there is this thing here. We could try it. I think, what is it? Can you hear this? It's just sound effect. There. What if you played number 8 of that?
Let's just try this.
Yeah, try that and see if it works. Yeah, yeah. Well, here we are. We're, you know, out here.
Number 8.
Come on, yet. That's number. That should be number 1. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Tasty. Very, very tasty.
Okay, all you guys who know about jazz and stuff. What tune was that? And no, we don't have to play that. We don't have to play Blindfold Test. That was Coltrane playing Body and Soul, but a lot of interesting things about that. But the main thing that, I guess the reason why playing it right after this other piece, that's a nice proximity. I didn't feel too bad about that, playing the Voyager piece with the computer with Roscoe Mitchell playing the saxophone, and then playing Coltrane after that, who, I mean, Coltrane had such a strong effect on everybody, and of course he had a strong effect on Roscoe and on a lot of people, and certainly on me, so that usually a day doesn't go by that I don't think about Coltrane. I don't think it would take that much to confess that I think about John Coltrane a lot more than I think about John Cage, but that's just personal. A lot of people think differently. So, but in any event, in a way, you want to learn from everyone, and I guess with the Voyager piece, you started to see maybe what, sort of how you can bring computer music into the, you know, into the African American musical idiom, so that when you don't necessarily lose your soul when you take up the computer or something, or you don't enter immediately into this totally European space when you pick up, you know, the computer, that you can still put your own thing into it, which is what you want to do, really.
That's what I said. You have this unique combination, you see, of, I really wanted to say braininess and soul, but I didn't want to get into any labels, so I said funk instead, but I really meant soul. Sort of a brain soul, you know.
Is it too late for brain? I'm sorry. Let's have more fun.
No. I remember Larry Polanski came on the show and he said, I really don't feel funny. And I said, Larry, I don't care. We're here to really, really play the music and chat a bit, but it's just the music.
Yeah.
You know, sort of speaks for itself. You know, sometimes the funniness happens and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't try to force anything.
No, you don't have to do
even
that.
Even me, even I, even Barb. So this is Crack O' Dawn you're listening to, it being the first Thursday of the month, and George Lewis, composer, performer extraordinaire, is live in the studio. Because you're at Mills College, you have the Mio chair for this spring semester.
Yeah, sitting in Mio's chair.
Visiting prof. So you're having fun there?
Yeah. I have this fantastic group of undergraduates. We talk about. I guess today's thing. We read some of Valerie Wilmer's stuff. Do you know her? She's a jazz critic for 35 years. She wrote this wonderful memoir, what was it called? Mama Said There'd Be Days Like This, mm-hmm. in which she sort of chronicles her, well, a kind of a change in her sexuality, which she made. You know, she came out as a lesbian, and how do you reconcile that with, like, jazz, which is so sort of supposedly this male, you know, sort of a homophobic kind of space, or it's reputed to be that. So that she tries to deal with that whole situation, and then the response of, like, British feminists to jazz, which a lot of them apparently didn't even want to listen to it. You know, said, "Well, this is a men's music." Although she points out that they didn't mind listening to Beethoven and the rest, as long as they were dead, white, and European, they didn't mind listening to men. But if they were black and they were alive, that was very difficult. And they say, "Well, this is a men's music," and so on. So, and then she talked about the women's music festival that used to take place in London, or it probably still does, in the Drill Hall, which is a festival which I took part in once with. We played, what was it, Maggie Nichols and Julie Driscoll and Irene Schweitzer and me, and that was it. Yeah, that was the group. It was a good group.
So this class that you're talking about, this is women sort of in music, like a women?
No, we cover different issues. You sort of deal with, like, identity, you know, sexual identity, gender identity, race identities, how these things get transmitted through music, and that's the sort of the idea of the class. So it sort of covers things like the role of the media and gatekeeping, why certain stuff gets on and why other stuff has to wait 17 years to get on, and things like that. So
was this a class where I went swimming around 5 o'clock, one of the lifeguards rushed up to me and she said, "George Lewis played your Clit Envy."
Oh, right,
In the class.
Yeah,
so I
wonder
if that was...
That's the class.
That's the class.
Well, you were under the section where we were talking about constructions of female desire. So that was what we were talking about. Which, it's an area I'm trying to, like, figure out for myself, because there are all these new sort of things, with this so-called queer musicology and all of that. I was on this sort of group of... It's sort of a think tank that took place at UC Irvine. It was called Retheorizing Music. And there are people like Susan McClary and Rob Walser and Paul Adnello, who I just saw the other day. I guess he's in town. And Jan Pasler and all these guys. And they had guests. There was Trisha Rose and Susan Foster, who you might remember, the dance critic and theorist. And, you know, this kind of theory is... It's kind of neat for me, because it kind of, a lot of stuff which I liked thinking about music is cool in this theory. In other words, the old music theory was, well, this is a note and this is another note and that's all there is to it, you know.
And now?
And this note just goes with that note and anything else is completely locked out, you know. But, you know, this sort of new sort of queer musicology, it allows other kinds of constructions, which you hear in the music anyway, to be put on. It's like when, well, this is a theory that I have. I hope people aren't offended by this. Remember, they used to always ask Coltrane and Archie Shepp and those guys, and they ask Coltrane, they'd say, "Well, look, this music sounds angry. I mean, are you angry? I mean, well, if he was, it wouldn't be unusual. I mean, this was 1960. We're talking about 2,000 lynchings later. Are you angry or not, you know?" I mean, were you angry when Emmett Till was lynched? I mean, are you mad about that? Is that a problem, you know? So people seemed very concerned that he not be angry. And he always said he wasn't angry. And I could go along with that on one level. On another level, I could see, well, maybe he wasn't in a position to say he was angry.
He wasn't?
Wasn't in a position to actually admit that he could have been angry about that. I mean, because of the situation of the 1960s with regard to silencing of black people's voices. So maybe it wasn't a thing where you could say right out, "Well, yeah, I'm a little ticked off at you guys. What do you think about that?" You know, so you'd sort of play it in the music, and the music would become, you know, the force through which all those things were heard. And that just seems so obvious.
Yeah.
But then when that becomes talked about, when people say, "Well, no, we can't talk about that. This is a G7 here, and you know, and this is 251, and you know, we're going from E-7 to F7 to B-flat, and that's the beginning of countdown, and that's all there is to it."
Why is it called queer musicology? Like queer as in homosexual, or queer as in odd?
I think queer as in
maverick sort of?
Yeah, yeah, maybe that's the sense of it. I mean, I'm not the best person to ask about this, being kind of a rookie in the whole whole thing. But there's, you know, there's a person that, there was, I think the title sort of got popularized by this book, Queering the Pitch, by Philip Brett. And the idea is that at a certain point, you're looking for a way to do musicology, which, yeah, I guess maverick would be, maybe that's the best face I could put on it, but which, I'm, you know, I don't think I want to go into it. I'm not sure I can talk about it at this hour with any kind of real coherence, but I'm going to say that it, maybe it kind of helped me, and I think it's helping the students at Mills to think about other ways of to think about their own musical experiences in new ways, you know.
Yeah, that's important. I mean, just to not get locked into anything. If you had just had to give one sentence of advice to a fledgling composer, performer, what would it be?
I don't know. I'd probably ask them a question rather than give them advice.
What would the question be?
Well, what are you listening to? Uh-huh. Maybe step one. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, you usually ask them, what, like, the old timers used to say, you listen to everything. Uh-huh. And actually, you had to take that literally. You really had to make sure you listened to everything. I mean, no matter what it was, you couldn't, like, say, well, I can't listen to that because it's, because it comes from these people. Well, how come we can't stop in the in the bathroom in the gas station or something? So all that kind of thing. You sort of, you know, growing up in the late 50s, you know, going to Georgia, Florida, wherever, where, you know, where my parents were from, you just sort of, that was just how it was. So finally, that became something that I wanted to kind of, you know, examine in the music and sort of trace that situation. Beyond that, the need to sort of let my dad kind of make his mark, you know, let him kind of make his mark on to something, and you know, the record says George Lewis. I mean, that's his name. So, I said, it's your text. Just tell him it's your record, man. You know, so he does that, and that's cool, as far as I'm concerned.
'42 found me working in defense for the unheard.
That was more of changing with the times. I mean, you know, what can we say about that?
With some beautiful solos by Mary Oliver.
Yeah, she was fantastic.
Violin, viola.
Country, blues, viola. Viola. Yeah, yeah, well, that was more of changing with the times. I mean, you know, what can we say about that?
With some beautiful solos by Mary Oliver.
Yeah, she was fantastic.
Violin, viola.
Country, blues, viola. Viola, Mary made it one of my favorite instruments. I started to see
how I know, I really like the way she plays it.
Yeah, yeah, and you can, and it fits very well with the trombone and some of the other instruments, the lower instruments, which I like so much.
I prefer it to violin, actually.
Well, I like them both.
I like all sort of alto tones.
Yeah, yeah. If you're playing it, it sounds good. I mean, I just love that deep sound, and it just sounds so great in the lower register. It's lovely, fantastic.
By the way, when the music's on, if you want to phone and talk to George Lewis, who is my guest this morning, the phone number is 510-848-4425. And before I forget, there's something at the lab. I think it's this weekend. It's remember the Illustrated Woman from last year. I can't believe 1 year has passed. It's called Utopia Dystopia, and it's a 3-day, you know, it's over this weekend. I think it's over this weekend. I'll find it and tell you more about it. But it's a symposium on kind of a whole woman thing, and it sounds really, really good. All kinds of people from Pamela Z, Anna Cooey, Rachel Rosenthal, Lynn Hirschman, and I just cannot see a date, so I'll let you know when that is, but I have a feeling that it might be this very weekend. And you can phone the lab at 415-346-4063. So,
you know what?
What?
What about this James P. Johnson stuff?
Oh, yeah. Like we were saying, you have this CD, Symphonic Music of James P. Johnson. I didn't even ever know he wrote symphonic music.
Yeah, I mean, it's just incredible. When you think about, listen to this line, I didn't know it either. It's super, it's beautiful. It's so well orchestrated. It's just extraordinary. And I mean, these are fully scored pieces. I mean, he studied, you know, music theory and counterpoint. I mean, it was all this time it was part of that whole Harlem Renaissance idea. I mean, he wrote the Carolina Shout. He wrote the Charleston. He made him kind of famous.
He wrote that
But he
song.
Couldn't, like, parlay that fame into, like, getting a even any kind of gig, like, you know, writing for an orchestra or sort of. And, see, this is the thing about that kind of thing. And, see, at that point, people were just erased. You know, black people were just erased out of that. And then a person, like I was reading, some sort of theorist that was saying that the reason why European immigrants got all the gigs writing Hollywood film scores, there was no one around, no one else around that could do it. And I was thinking, well,
not true.
What?
BS.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. But yeah. I mean, it made a pretty good theory.
Yeah.
But the reality seemed to be more like this, where he said, well, there was no interest in these. It's more established and still segregated music community. Johnson applied for fellowships to support his studies and wrote to many conductors and musical benefactors for his pieces to be given a performance. His scrapbooks are filled with rejection letters, but despite little recognition and limited encouragement, James P. Johnson wrote 2 symphonies, a piano and clarinet concerto, 2 ballets, 2 one-act operas, and a number of sonatas, suites, tone poems, and a string quartet.
God.
Yeah, that's not, you know, and boy. Anyway, I think it's great, so maybe you should check some of it out and see what you think. I think this one's called April in Harlem.
So that's Symphonic Music of James P. Johnson. What was that title again?
It's from the Harlem Symphony. It's called April in Harlem. It's the second movement. Extraordinary piece. Very similar in certain ways. It has the same kind of opening thing, especially with the oboe, as the Symphony No. 2 by William Grant Still, who is better known for the Afro-American Symphony. And I mean, this is a kind of a genre in American music. I mean, the most commonly played pieces are the Gershwin pieces, Rhapsody in Blue, American in Paris. But I would say that if I look at somebody like William Grant Still as kind of the dean, in a way, or American composers, and who the people that came after him, Ulysses Kay, who they think they used to call the old man. I don't know if he'd dig that. And then Hale Smith, T.J. Anderson, and Ollie Wilson, representing the younger generation, who's actually chairman of the music department at Berkeley right now. Wendell Logan, and the person we're about to play, who's Ed Bland, represents kind of a distinct strain of African-American sort of, I don't know what you could call it, it's kind of transcultural composition. It's not,
yeah, well, it's got the European influence, and then all the je ne sais quoi.
Well, it's that hybrid. Well, I sort of know, just say. You say quoi?
I'm too tired. I know.
Yeah. You I know say it's just quoi. This, yeah, it's kind of that. Well, it's that, you know, I mean, in some quarters it's called hybridity, coming out of W.E.B. Du Bois. This idea of, sort of having that double consciousness, having this sort of dual heritage, or even you could think of it as a triple heritage if we're including Africa, African America, and Europe. It's even more complex than that. I mean, that's the thing about music, is that it's kind of hard to simply say, well, this is coming from here, especially in the American context, because everybody's coming from many different places, it seems to me.
When we were making that movie Tia, we had to find some. We wanted to find some symphonic South American music, and it was the same idea, the same hybridization. The European tradition, but some stuff would happen that would never happen from Europe, like really repeated notes and different kinds of syncopations, and it was really great. You know, Chavez and.
Vueltas. I mean, you take the stuff and you put your own stamp on it. If you don't do that, then I mean, what good is it if you don't put your own stamp on it? So,
well, it's just imitative. If you don't,
well, if you don't do it, then well, you're going to do it. I mean, that's the thing. People are going to do it, and then when it comes back to when it goes back to, some people will recognize it, and other people say, well, what is that weird thing you put in there? I mean, I guess I get that about the computer music. So, well, what is that funny thing that's going on in there? What are those people improvising? Sure they are, man. What do you think they're supposed to be doing?
Well, I even used to get that when I'd write a song and I had no idea what I was doing particularly. I was just writing a melody and then, you know, having the chords that went with it, and people would say, do you know what you just did? You put like a three with a two. You know, they'd say, they'd give me this theory, and they'd say, well, why did you do that? You know, so stuff like that.
Right.
And I said, well,
Well, you could just, you know, say, well, this is found in Haydn Symphony No. 87. Just send them to the books.
There you go.
So I didn't find it there. I said, well, didn't you look?
Like quoting the Bible or something. By the way, that women's conference I was telling you about, what is this weekend, the 7th through the 9th, and it takes place at Yerba Buena, and it's sponsored by the lab and SF Camera Work. And the place, I did give you the right number, 415-346-4063. So probably if you think you want to go, phone tomorrow morning, because it's going to be sold out. It sure was last year, and it was worth going to. And if I wasn't working at the markets on Saturday and Sunday, I'd be there. But I can't. So.
Well, what do you think?
Well, what do we have? We had, did we have USQ?
Yeah, well, not yet. Let's listen to this brass quintet thing of Ed Bland, the second movement. You say, this is kind of what we're talking about. When you hear this brass quintet, you can see it's not just...
Is that on this?
It should be, yeah. I don't know. Okay. What do you got on there? I can't see what you're doing over there.
I got James P. Johnson there, and I got Uptown String Quartet there.
Oh, you got the Uptown... No, you got... I think you got Bland there, because I got Uptown String Quartet here.
Okay, cool.
Just play number 13, I think is the one.
Let's do it.
No Triskaidekaphobia here.
Let's do it.